All right, everybody, welcome to the Metal Hammer Podcast. It is episode 171. I am Mel from Metal Hammer, which you might already know by now, but if you don't, hello, welcome to the podcast. We'd love to have you. The latest issue of Metal Hammer is out right now. tinyurl.com/gethammer is the address to get it delivered straight to your door, or you can pop to your nearest store, stock a Metal Hammer, go to tinyurl.com/findhammer to find where your nearest store is. We are celebrating 20 years of Iowa by Slipknot, one of the greatest and most significant heavy metal albums of all time, an album that was fraught with tension, turbulence, and a ton of crazy stuff going on behind the scenes. We talked to the band and various people that were on the scene at the time about Iowa and its legacy and all the chaos that was going on at the time. It's a hell of a feature. You need it in your life. Go out and get that right now. Do it. This week's special guest is very, very linked to that cover feature as well, but I'll get onto that in a minute, because I should also tell you that we have some lovely sponsors these days. The wonderful people at Killstar, one of the world's greatest leading alternative fashion brands. They sponsor this podcast. We appreciate them very much. They have a fantastic range of clothing, shoes, accessories, and lifestyle items for all kind of people from all walks of life. Go to killstar.com to check out all their excellent ranges. I'm on the website right now, actually. They have shoes here. They've got t-shirts. They've got hoodies, dresses. They've got some spider earrings. They're pretty crazy. They've got mugs, leggings. They just dropped a whole new homeware range as well, so you can kit yourself out and your house out to look metal as hell. They're the coolest alternative fashion and lifestyle brand there is right now, so jump over to killstar.com and get in on all of that. I've got my eyes on some particularly spooky salt and pepper shakers that I can see. They look pretty cool. They go down a tree at my house. We recommend them very, very much, so go over to killstar.com to check out all of that right now. Right, this week's show features a world-exclusive interview with the godfather of nu metal himself. I'm talking about Ross Robinson, one of the most influential and important producers in the history of our music. He is one of the elites when it comes to heavy metal production. He is the man behind legendary albums by the likes of Korn, Sepultura, Slipknot, Limp Bizkit, Soulfly. I mean, so much of the metal that defined the 90s and early 2000s was influenced by the work of this man. And Metal Hammer deputy editor Eleanor Goodman conducted a long interview with the man himself a few weeks back. The interview was for two pieces. One will be rolling out in the magazine in a few months' time, and the other was for this month's aforementioned Explosive Iowa issue. I talked about it just now. Ross was the man behind the production desk for Slipknot's classic Iowa album, and we talked to him for the cover feature, along with various members of the band and other key personnel, as I mentioned. But Ross's material on Iowa was so good that we just decided to run a ton of it right here on the podcast as well, as an exclusive for you lot. So Elle and Ross talk about the emotional turmoil at the heart of making Iowa. They chat about the relationships in the band at that point. Ross talks about his favourite moments on the record and much, much more. It's all on here and it's all great stuff. I should add that this interview didn't take place via our usual podcast software. It was done as a phone interview, so the audio is a little different to usual, but you're still going to get a ton of great stories and insight from Ross, and it is well worth your time. I promise you that. If you were there, if you know about this time in metal, you're going to want to hear what Ross has got to say about Iowa. It's really eye-opening stuff. And then, of course, don't forget to pick up the latest issue of Metal Hammer as well to read even more about Iowa as we celebrate its 20th anniversary. Also, just want to note that Ross talks about Left Behind being his favourite Corey vocal performance in this interview, but he messaged us after the chat to clarify that he actually meant Disaster Piece. So he's kind of, that's what he's talking about when he mentions that Left Behind is his favourite Corey vocal performance. But anyway, I've talked enough now, hasn't it? You want to hear Ross Robinson, so let's get on to it. With that all said, I'm going to hand you over to Elle and Ross right now. Enjoy.
I just worried if there's any trepidation about going back into the studio with Slipknot after a self-titled record. Just, I guess, one, having to sort of live up to...
How to bring the nine dudes together.
Oh, yeah.
So what happened during drum tracking, you know, I was completely obsessed with motocross. I started really, really, it's my passion, my life and all this stuff, like since right before at the drive-in record. And I hurt myself for the first time during at the drive-in, and the record came out really good. And, So during Slipknot, I thought it would be a really good idea to hit the track on, I think, our first day off. And I broke my back.
Yeah.
And we were in the studio for almost, like, pretty much all of the drums. We were about 90% there, and there was a lot of editing going on and you know, some overdubbed, you know, to fix some parts here and there. And people were partying. It was, you know, people weren't talking. And, you know, and I was pretty much, you know, like, getting frustrated with, it's not the same, you know, like, as far as, we need to bring this together. We need to have this great meeting and come together and with management. So everybody, you know, like, I was in their business, and, you know, which I learned not to do, especially during that record. And so I showed up, I missed a day after breaking my back, and then showed up in extreme pain on time, in time, and said, let's get it the fuck on. And they turned into Slipknot One again, you know, as far as showing up, because if I was doing it, they had no excuse. you know, with all that extreme pain, you know, there is some craziness, and also it was stream of consciousness, and I was on painkillers towards the end of the night, and the pain and then, you know, the relief. I would wait for vocals and before I would take my medication to get some relief, and before that it was about just gritting my teeth. And so a lot of my memory of it is erased because I was escaping dealing with mental pain and showing up, and then obviously having to take stuff to be able to just breathe. And it didn't create a safe environment for them like the first one did.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned
which is probably why they didn't call me in to do any other music, I would imagine.
Do you not think they would have enjoyed being, like, you were sort of part of the chaos, though, surely, in Iowa?
Oh, yeah. Well, a record producer's job is to set the tone and be the light, you know, to hold that space and for the first time in my life with experiencing such extreme physical pain, you know, like if I wasn't getting a performance, you know, I would push and push and push, you know, to get cravings satisfied. And when, say, you know, the marker was if the pain went away, then it meant that I saw a great performance and the opiates just rushed through my body from the performance, you know. And so subconsciously I was going for that hit, you know, using them as my medicine. And you know, the key word was use. And you know, if I didn't get that thing, it was, you know, whatever it took. And I mean, that's kind of my recollection of the extreme performance and the wildness of what you feel on that record. It's very heavy.
Yeah. What actually happened to you in the motocross accident?
Oh, so I cruised out to this track in the desert that has really big jumps, and I thought, and the bike that I had was this new they switched the motors from two-stroke to four-stroke. Most people won't know what that is, but there was this thing called engine braking that with the two-stroke, the back wheel just spins freely. And with the four-stroke, this new version, the back wheel would slow down when it was in the air. And so if the back wheel slows down, it throws the back wheel over the back of your head and you endo and you crash, like it's just ruthless. And so my skill level wasn't able to handle that bike at the time. And I basically, you know, I did this, I think it was a 75 or 80 foot jump, and the back wheel just came over the back of my head, and I went head first into the ground, and it felt like my body bent in half, hyperextending the wrong way. And I was laying there in the dirt, and my sister was there at the time, and she does massage and stuff. And I'm like, all you need to do is massage it. Just massage it and it'll be okay. And they're scraping me up with a freaking wood plank and taking me to the hospital. And it was ruthless, ruthless, ruthless pain. And and then those poor guys had to, you know, they stuck by me, which I'm so grateful for. It must have been really tough. Really tough. And we made it through. Yeah.
Well, how long, I think the band have said you were in the studio like the day after the accident, is that correct? Were you kind of in there straight away?
Yes.
Wow, I didn't, okay.
Yeah, music, everything I do is to rip, you know, for the music. And so the motocross in a way is preparation. Like I like to tell everybody, you know, as we're walking across the street to get a coffee, I'll go, what are we doing? And they return, the return answer, proper answer is, we're making a fucking record. So the injury is making the record, and it's all purposeful, and there's no mistakes in it. And I remember Joey saying, this is the best thing, and Paul, this is the best thing that's ever happened to us. I'm like, fuck yeah. And then, you know, I had my helmet that was all scraped up, and I think it was even broken. It's sitting on top of one of the heads, and the Marshall head or something. And you know, by the end of the record, they were so, like, stoked on it, you know, as far as the violence and the extremeness of all of it, that I think five of them ended up with dirt bikes.
Wow.
After that. Yeah, that's how insane we were. Yeah. That's not normal.
Well, I read that you're in a wheelchair as well, and I imagine if your back was literally broken, that is the case. I'm surprised you weren't lying down, to be honest, but I'm guessing you were in a wheelchair in the studio, just on the painkillers, trying to make this work.
Yeah, it wasn't a wheelchair. It was, I just wrapped my back, and if I leaned forward at all or backwards at all, it was so ruthless. And so for just a little bit, I did a Rick Rubin and laid on the couch that he lays on. And that's his thing, lay and listen. And which is, I learned really good technique. If you're listening, you're hearing. So if you're doing, you're, you know, it's, anyway. So during drum editing, you know, I was there, you know, and then we do the fixed parts and stuff like that. I was there for all the tracking of, you know, standing upright and out of pain for the tracking of the drums. And so, you know, it took us a little over a month, I think, to get the drums edited and all done. And so, you know, they're mm-hmm. so great when they're when they're playing together and pulsing, as you've seen live, you know, a million times. It's unbeatable, and that's what we captured. And it wasn't a rushed process or anything like that. So right when we started guitars and bass, I was able to sit in a chair, you know, and do my guitar pedal thing and all that, and get deep into the creative process of the overdubs. But we captured the rip, you know, the absolute mm-hmm. fire before I crashed. So that was it. See that you see how perfect that is? It's just in line, in time, perfectly. And every single day since that accident, I feel pain, like there's something. And recently it's subsided a lot, and through diet and, you know, and taking really good care of myself. I remember that record every day. It lives in my body as annoying pain.
That's crazy that it literally lives in your body.
Yeah.
I think one of the members as well said that you were like screaming, and that's in one of the tracks. Do you remember which track that's in, and is that something you kind of remember doing in the studio, like getting your sort of pain out there?
Well, you know, the screaming isn't if you listen to just the drum tracks, it's in every song, and hopefully other people are doing it too. I love hyping it and, you know, getting the intention across, you know, so we do a lot of mental surgery before the song to know why and what you're doing for the purpose, and really, really, really believe in what the vocal is giving, you know, the lyric, and find why it resonates through each person. And so the intensity is like, yeah, or fucking rip, go, you know. And it's in a huge, like when it's turning on, there's this incredible joy, and it just comes out of me. And because they're playing it through their instruments and slamming, and I'm screaming and like, yeah, you know, and it's all one, you know, it's beautiful. Yeah, it's a good combination.
Well, just to make sure I got the timeline right, how long did the record take to record from start to finish, and when did you have your accident within that time frame?
The accident was probably 3 weeks in.
Yeah.
And I think it took us 2.5 months.
Yeah. Well, I know a lot of the other members of Slipknot were all going through it as well. Corey told us that in one take he cut himself with a candle and like threw up. What do you remember of his vocal takes? What kind of stands out for you in that sort of emotional pain realm?
The thing that stands out from my experience watching him, and, you know, getting into him and listening to him and being there, I would always, you know, basically lay down in front of him while he did the vocal, and, you know, and we do live takes from top to bottom to get that extreme live experience, and not the 2020, hey, let's punch in the chorus first. Hey, let's do the verse, you know. No, let's double it, you know. It, none of that none of that existed on Iowa or the first record. It was all about giving and feeling everything that you're writing about. So whatever he wrote about was what he had to feel. And so his traumatic lyrics were being emoted pure. And I think whenever somebody is absolutely authentic in whatever it is that they're giving, the body just gets overwhelmed with those body chills, because it's not really, say, the pain or the suffering or blah, blah, blah. It's the authenticity and the realness of what he's expressing that would also take me out of pain. It would go away. And if it was just kind of, be like, all right, what's going on? Tell me, you know, where are you? Say it again. Why? And I think that process is so, you know, for somebody as talented as him, you know, it's not necessary to go that deep and that miserable, if you write miserable stuff, you know, to be a talented, great, multi-platinum artist. It's just mega extra credit that I think is timeless and never dies. And it allows people to feel the feelings that they're feeling that resonate with that subject as well. And, you know, and when you open the heart, you capture the person forever. You know, mm-hmm. You're the safe place. And he's a master and so special at being able to do that. All of those guys. It's incredible.
Is there a moment you remember where you really pushed him, like a particular take on a particular song, and where he came out with something that you were just really blown away by?
Left Behind. I think that's the one. I would feel so emotional about it, but he gave everything. And it's so real, and it's the high bar of giving and selflessness and healing and vulnerability. God, doesn't get better. That's the high bar. That vocal performance to me is the holy grail. You know, I always, you know, Jonathan did it on Daddy, and you know, it's just that I've been able to experience seeing a few of those. It's just so special. That's what sticks out. The dude just fucking opened his heart and was left raw, naked, and seen. And that's what everybody's afraid of. That's the cause of war. And he's ending war with that song. Beautiful.
What was he singing about? Because I could take a guess, you know, and say it's about his father or, you know.
You got it. That's it. Yeah. It's just, you know, the pain of thinking somebody should be there and be part of his life and, you know, and the treachery in his mind and his heart and his soul that, you know, feeling less than and thrown away. And it's just, you know, all of us can relate to that through, you know, getting fired from a job or get somebody breaking up with us, or, you know, it's the human condition to think that if they don't love me, then there's something wrong with me. And and then you pile thousands and thousands of stories on top of it, and it's your proof that I'm a piece of shit and all of this stuff. And, you know, these are the things that we go into, you know, and I, you know, tell me how it feels. It's okay.
What about Clown? We're speaking to him sometime in the next few days about the record, but I saw an interview with him and he said, we all almost died. So obviously he was feeling something very strongly there.
Well, yeah, I think it had a lot to do with, you know, well, they did die and they were reborn into a whole new identity that, you know, who is able to transition from being normal, you know, kind of maybe low income to middle income Iowa kids to being heroes and having, you know, all these big deals come in and everybody just loves them and they're up for a Grammy. And, you know, just like, check me out. And then there's, you know, band stuff going on, like, within each other. And it's just, and I think the manager at the time was very, very toxic. He was, I didn't like him at all. And I was being really protective, but I had no business doing that. And I think Sean was kind of, you know, in the middle of me and that, you know, and that die was the difference between all about the music on the first record and then all of a sudden these kids are just thrown into an absolute whirlwind of insanity, you know. It was crazy. And I have to put that as myself as well. You know, I'm a desert kid from Barstow, California, halfway between LA and Vegas. And I had, you know, it was just unnatural for a desert rat to be in the position I was in and being given massive record deals with major labels, and it was insane. And so I'm not clean, you know. The egos were fucking out of control. Yeah.
Well,
not between the band and me. You know, I think we had our little wolf pack thing, but you know, and trust in that, but, you know, just outside of the trying to figure out life.
Well, what would we have seen if we'd walked into the studio just on any given day?
So you walk into Sound City, which is, you turn off the ugliest part of the valley, and you go into this ugly, ugly building with no grass. It's just like a black hot parking lot, and then you go into this ugly hallway, and you walk by this down this hallway into the control room door, and there were these Kiss stand-up Kiss dolls that were like 3 feet high, and you kick the bass and they play different Kiss songs, so everybody would hit the Kiss. Somebody would hit their favorite Kiss band member, and so that was fun. There were these bottles of herbs that the manager was buying for each band member that were $1,200 a piece, sitting there on a shelf that people would just drink, and you know, all then I had my video game in the lobby area with that was just super 70s looking, just crappy, and you could smell old cat food in there. And but the thing about it is, you know, Nevermind was made in there, and
yeah,
Fleetwood Mac did their first couple of records there, and oh my god, it's just the historical value. And then the console was super special, which girl made that movie.
Yeah.
And the Sound City. So yeah, there was carpet on the walls, this ugly brown carpet, and for me it was super cool. Like I loved the vibe of it. And I didn't know it, but I clown hated our engineer Mike Frazier. I hated his pirate flags. And I didn't know until like maybe a year after we recorded or something. I read it in an interview, but Frazier comes in and just pins up his pirate flags and we're on a pirate ship. and he was, clown was so bummed on it. And but we did it. Yeah. And during drum tracking and editing, we edited on tape. So we marked every single kick and snare and tom on the whole record. And you can hear how busy Joey plays. Mm. And so the way I would edit, you know, you can hear it on the first record and as well, is the edits, I would take out the lulls and leave all the rushes. You know, I'd find a groove and use that to measure, like a 2-4-bar groove or something. And that would be my measuring of markers. And then I would match the markers on the tape. And then we'd slice out these little baby slivers. And these tiny little slivers went all the way around the control room, taped up. And it was extreme cobbling. And and what you hear at the end of that is this massive urgency that's just breathtaking. It's like, oh my god.
Mm.
So you see these little slivers and everybody's like, oh, I wonder what they sound like if you taped them all together. And so that was a thing. And I think Clown has all of those.
Wow.
Yeah, just he has them.
Awesome. Well, yeah. Why do you think Iowa became such a commercial success? It got to number one in the UK and almost got to number one in the US. And it's a record with death metal influences, with people screaming in pain on it. That's pretty incredible, really.
Metal bands can just simply use that as a template that want to be extreme and discover choruses. Like, oh, a chorus. And obviously, you know, they're so musically, you know, intuitive, and, you know, all of us working together and having, you know, structure and proper beat, you know, and, you know, where it sticks out and comes alive, you know, that's, I think, as far as commercial radio, technical. But then we go back to that thing with when I was describing Left Behind, you put that on it and then all of a sudden, you know, it's reminiscent to a Queen record where you got Freddie Mercury just bleeding on the mic, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's just so authentic and also structured well.
How do you feel looking back at the record now, 20 years on?
Moved, grateful. So grateful. Iowa came out right before 9/11, or I think on 9/11, and their tour was canceled, and it was the record that was pushed out. They made another record, you know, soon. I think they toured 3 months, and it was not full houses because people were scared of terrorists, and
yeah,
and so everything was canceled. And so what happened is it became the sleeper Slipknot album. It's a discovery today where, like, say, if I look at numbers or whatever, you know, plays, it's smoking. I can't believe it. Like, people listen to it like it's never been out this whole time. And I think that it's so powerful that it became a sleeper classic.
Hmm.
And you know, where if it was properly toured and just pushed and pushed and pushed, you know, that it's like, oh God, you know, it's like, well, give me something new. And to me, it's always new, and there's always going to be new fans that discover it and like, oh, what the hell happened? You know?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Yeah, I think that some of the tour dates were pushed back because of fears of terrorism. So having to release a record and then go out into a world that people have never seen before in modern times, it's a very strange thing to do, I imagine, for them.
Yeah, and we're experiencing it now with, you know, I made two records that were released last year, and people just, you know, it's come and gone. It's bizarre, you know, without the touring.
Is there anything else you wanted to add about Iowa?
I think I'm just so proud and so grateful for it, and I'm so grateful that those guys chose me to do it, and you know, I'm really sure that some insane, hurtful, crazy things came out of my mouth, and you know, it was, for me, it was survival, you know, through such extreme, you know, physical situation, and yeah, something happened that I'm not sure of, but I'm grateful for it, and I would do it again the same exact way. I'd take the crash. I would be a complete psychomaniac and, you know, think I knew something, which today I know I don't know anything, and you know, life knows, and it's not up to us to control anything. And yeah, and I just learned so much about, you know, connecting and being, you know, there for people when they need me during that record. And
yeah, it sounds like you were, sorry, go on.
No, that's it.
I was just going to say, it sounds like it changed you quite profoundly in a lot of ways.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It was heavy. It was heavy. Yeah. All gratitude. Well, you know, the thing about it was the extreme success and all the money and, you know, whatever, all the stuff and all that. I think it hit all of us really, really hard. And, you know, I kind of see it without tools and being able to mentally get through it properly, it's a death sentence. And, you know, if you're a people pleaser, it's kind of a death sentence. And, you know, it's a highway to growth, you know, I think that it made all of us much, much wiser people, the experience of all of it.
All right, that is all from Eleanor Goodman and the legendary Ross Robinson for now. Pick up the latest issue of Metal Hammer from tinyurl.com/gethammer or in your local shops across the UK to read more on Iowa. We've got members of the band in there. We've got Ross in there, of course, and we've got other great people as well that were right there on the front lines for one of the most explosive albums in the history of metal. Go pick up the latest issue for all that. And we'll also have more from Ross in a future issue of the magazine as well. Don't forget to head over to killstar.com to visit our lovely sponsors, Killstar, and check out all their latest ranges and wares. Still got my eye on those salt and pepper shakers, by the way. We will see you right back here on the Metal Hub podcast next week. We are going to do a review roundup, and there are some big, big albums that we haven't talked about yet. We haven't talked about Out the Gates yet. We haven't talked about Beartooth. We haven't talked about Backwash. There is loads of great stuff coming out right now, and we're going to review and go in deep on all of that. So we'll see you next week. Goodbye, everybody. We'll be right back.